Insperity presents the Small Business Advocate Show with Jim Blasingame. This is a copyrighted production of Small Business Network, Inc. All rights reserved.
Happy anniversary, baby. Got you on my mind. Happy anniversary, baby. Got you on my mind.
We're back. It's 12 after the hour. Thank you very much for joining us. Thanks for hanging out with me. Thanks for being part of my day. It's my pleasure. I'm Jim Blasingame, the Small Business Advocate. Joan Pride is our guest. Joan, happy anniversary, baby.
Well, thank you, Jim. I appreciate it.
And little River Band bringing us back there. Tell the audience why we're celebrating the anniversary.
Well, it's the anniversary of the founding of the Kiplinger Letter.
How many years?
85.
85, and
Watch it.
Well, you came along much later, Joan.
Many years later. Many generations.
Generations later, not just decades, but generations later, right? How does it feel now, folks? I think we're going to take a second here because this is important. This is an 85-year-old family-owned small business.
And we're in the third generation of it, too, which is what I find really amazing.
Third generation.
Yep.
The founder's son, Austin, who is 85, who is 90.
90.
As you know, we celebrated his 90th birthday on the show on Tuesday.
Right.
And this is a family-owned, still really a small business, even though you got a couple hundred employees, I guess. That's still a small business. And, Joan, you're basically all in the same building, and you're fighting in a marketplace that's made up of behemoths.
Yes.
So what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I'm still amazed that this company couldn't do it, but I'm amazed that any company can make it that long, given all the challenges, particularly today in the publishing industry. Mm-hmm. I think it says a lot that a company tries to keep it small and family-owned, and I just give them a lot of credit for being able to do it.
Well, and I'll tell you, I've thought a lot about this, Joan, because as you know, I've been covering the Kiplinger Letter for almost 11 years now, over 10 for sure, with one person before you. And I think it's a testament to the Kiplinger people, the individuals. And the reason I say that is, when I think about how highly regarded Willard must have been to actually get this off the ground, and then I think about how highly regarded Austin must, I know how highly regarded he is in the industry. And now Knight, his son, has taken over. I mean, not to minimize the people behind them. Clearly, they got a great staff, great organization, especially one particular one, right, Joan?
And, absolutely.
But I mean, seriously, you know, I think the Kiplinger name just has been, because of the individuals, has really been able to hold a high level of cachet in the marketplace. What do you think?
Well, and you think about what they've had to do to be able to survive and the problems they've had to withstand in the economy. I'm sure, I have to believe, I don't have any knowledge of this, but I have to believe that, you know, big companies have wanted to gobble them up.
Yep.
And I'm assuming that since they're still here, they must have said, no, we want to stay independent. We want to stay privately owned. And they've stuck it out through good times and bad, and there have been bad times.
Yep.
But instead of folding up their tent or selling out, they've stuck with it.
Well, I know one of the challenges that I've witnessed has been the conversion to the Internet.
Right, and that's
the biggest challenge of all so far. That was a real tough time for every publishing company. In fact, many publishing companies are still having a problem with that.
Yeah, absolutely. But across the board, publishing,
yeah,
particularly magazine publishing, still is having a very, very difficult time.
Right. And, I mean, I remember Steve Forbes was on the show a few years ago, and he declared very proudly on the show one day, hey, guess what? Our website is profitable now.
Yeah.
You know, I mean that was a red letter day for him.
That's huge, yeah.
It is, yeah.
Right.
And so, anyway, congratulations, Joan.
Thank you.
We were so fortunate. it was just coincidental that we were there on that night, and you were nice enough to invite us to come by and congratulate Mr. Kiplinger. It was just a great time to see how people cared so much about him, all the people there in the building. I mean, he's not just one, you know, the leader emeritus, folks. He's beloved in that building, isn't he?
Oh, no question about it. And it really, when you're with the group of people in a situation like that, you get to understand why being part of a family-run company is so important.
Well, to me, Joan, it was an example of why people come to an organization, why they stay, because through good times and bad times, people work in small businesses because they believe in the vision and the values of the people they work for and the organization they work for. I like what Napoleon said, Joan. He said, "A soldier will fight long and hard for a bit of colored ribbon." For an idea, you know, for a principle, for a value. People will do that. People stay with, why do people stay with companies so long when they maybe could go somewhere else? Because they just feel right being there. And I think the Kiplinger story is a good one to, somebody should write about that and should write a story about that and use it as an example for how to build a family owned and a small business and get people to stay with you.
And still remain ethical and true to the values that you started the company with.
Absolutely. So congratulations on 85 years, Joan. By the way, I actually have a copy of the very first edition. And what's incredible, Joan, is it was just one sheet of paper, both sides. The Kiplinger letter is now is twice as big, but still only four sides, so to speak, a folded 8.5 by 17 sheet, and it's still, I mean, there's some changes, but to a large degree, the little snippets that of information that you guys put out is still very much like the original, and still successful that way.
Right, and I know this is the tax letter, not the Kiplinger letter I'm commenting on, but our readers who tend to be accountants say, you know, I don't have time to read lots and lots and lots of stuff. I need small snippets that maybe give me an idea of where I want to get more information, or it's mm-hmm. just all I need to read to know what I need to know.
It's pretty cool how this has been handed down. And folks, as you know, we celebrate lots of small businesses on this show, and none that's a more beautiful example of that than the Kiplinger folks at the Kiplinger Editors. We'll take a quick break. We're going to get to the most recent Kiplinger letter right after these messages. I'm Jim Blassingame. Stay with us. Joan Pryde is our guest. We're back. It's 23 after the hour. I'm Jim Blassingame, the Small Business Advocate. My websites are smallbusinessadvocate.com and askjim.biz. Check them out. Use them to your advantage. We built them for you. No barrier to entry. If you can get there, we'll let you use our stuff. Just come on in and use all of our stuff at smallbusinessadvocate.com and askjim.biz. By the way, that second one is a knowledge base where you can ask questions and get answers. Joan Pryde is our guest. She's senior editor with the Kiplinger Editors. We're celebrating the Kiplinger Editors' 85th anniversary. Joan, the lead story, the lead lines, the lead sentences in the letter this week are, it's historic, it's dramatic. Are those the best examples you could come up with to describe what's happening right now?
Hey, I didn't write this.
momentous, unprecedented, unbelievable. That's kind of, those are the words that come to my mind.
It could be. It well could be unbelievable.
Yeah. Well, it's some politicians who are not believing what they're being offered right now, aren't they?
Oh, absolutely. That's why this hasn't passed yet. There's still a lot of haggling back and forth.
And of course, we're talking about this the Treasury Secretary, Hank Paulson, and the Fed Chairman, Mr. Ben Bernanke, are trying to make a sale on Capitol Hill right now, aren't they, John?
Oh, absolutely.
They're trying to convince the Congress and the administration, I guess. I'm not sure the administration is completely on board with this, but I guess they are. They're trying to convince the government to put in $700 billion to bail out the financial sector of the marketplace.
Right.
and you know, here's how much we want. We want it now, and basically, we're going to decide how we're going to spend it. We meaning Mr. Paulson and Mr. Bernanke.
Right.
And that's not going down so well, is it, Joan?
Well, not among a lot of people.
Democrats and Republicans.
That's true. There are some Democrats and some Republicans that are not sure this is the right bailout, or maybe it's too big, or something like that. Or the Democrats are asking for certain, I guess, concessions, such as new restrictions on executive pay, for example.
Now, here's what's interesting, Joan, about what's going on. People who like to be able to forecast where we're going in 3, 6, 12, 18 months are having to give two stories, aren't they? They're having to say, well, if the buyout goes through, this is what's going to happen. If it doesn't, this is what's going to happen.
Right.
Right. I mean, it's difficult because it's as if the world is hanging on what the government is going to do.
Yeah, it sure seems like, in a sense, that it is. That's right.
And so if that's the case, so if the government does this, I mean, I think most people believe that there's going to be, you know, that there will be quite a bit of, I don't think anybody argues that it won't settle down the financial markets, it won't free up some capital, and that in the short term, this won't be the right thing to do, even though there are questions about the details. But Joan, my concern in the long term is the government getting this much entrenched in basically the wellspring of our capitalism, which is Wall Street.
Right. Right, exactly.
So I'm concerned about that. But so and so my point is the letter here that we're working off of talks about fundamental weaknesses remain in the marketplace.
Yes.
Consumer spending lacks any oomph, you guys say. That's
yep.
OOMPH, by the way, folks, if you're wondering how to spell that.
Yep. That's onomatopoeia, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Wage gains, lag inflation, and the jobless situation. All of these things, really, if next Monday we have a deal or we don't have a deal, there'll be two different directions that we'll go in, right?
That's exactly right.
Because if the government does it, let's say that this thing falls through. I don't think it will. I think it'll go through. But let's say it falls through. Then what does Mr. Bernanke and Mr. Paulson do? Where do they go? What happens after that?
Well, I think that's the big unanswered question.
And that's what's got people kind of holding their breath to see
right. What's
going to happen. And of course, as you know, Joan, this afternoon, the president is meeting with both presidential candidates and the leaders of Congress to try to work something out.
Right.
And so, so what are the issues now, Joan? Are the issues that whether the big sticking points, I think, in Congress now are whether to give them all the money or give it to them in what they call tranches.
Okay.
Is that what you've been reading? You know, whether to give them $150 billion at a time or all of it at once. But you know, Joan, when you look at the you know, like the housing market, you guys reported on the housing market this week. It's still a huge negative, but what will it look like on the other side of these, you know, of these decisions that are going to have to be made? That's the key. And I mean, don't all these things look different this week than they did last week?
Well, and I think that people keep asking, where is the bottom of the housing crisis? And
right.
We apparently still haven't found it yet.
Well, yeah, and we'll find the bottom two different ways, I think, depending on what the government does. I mean, there's a lot of uncertainty based on which way this thing works out. And I don't think we'll be able to call that or even imagine what that could be until these guys in their meetings, one way or another. 29 after, we're going to be right back. I'm Jim Blassingame. Stay with us.
You're listening to the smartest man in talk radio.
You're going to be listening to one of the smartest people that you probably, and you know who this guy is. It's me.
He's Jim Blasingame.
I am the smart. I am the smart. S-M-R-T. I mean S-M-A-R-T.
The Small Business Advocate.
We're back. It's 34 after the hour. Thanks very much for hanging out with us. I'm Jim Blasingame, and I'm glad you're here. Joan Pride is our guest. She's senior editor with the Kiplinger Editors. Joan, one last thought on this financial crisis thing. The world is not just the United States, but the world is literally holding its breath now to see what happens, because there is no decoupling of the United States economy from the world economy, is there? I mean, we've now proved that there was some theory that, you know, we could somehow be decoupled, and whatever happens to us doesn't, you know, if we catch a cold, the rest of the world doesn't get pneumonia. You know, that we now know that that's not true anymore, right?
Boy, that's right, yeah.
And so imports, exports, all that's going to be affected. And therefore, it's going to be affect a global thing. And so, you know, that's one of the challenges when you think about what the guys are debating, the men and women are debating in Washington right now about what to do with the government involvement in financial crisis. It's more than just the United States economy they have to think about, isn't it?
That's right. Exactly.
China and Europe and all that. So it'll be interesting. Joan, let's there's another issue. If you thought that this was scary enough, Joan, the Fed has other things to worry about, like credit card debt, right?
That's right. And that, boy, that, you know, there's some talk that that could be the next crisis. If consumers are having problems making their credit card payments, what happens, you know, in that arena?
One of the things that happened this year, a phenomenon that happened this year, Joan, that the small business owners found out about. A lot of small businesses operate their capital, their working capital. A lot of it comes from credit cards.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
And not to say that they're even if they're not undercapitalized too much, even if they're, but they just use the credit card to give them some 30-day money instead of having to go to the bank. And it's a very handy thing to do. It can be very productive. It just has to be managed well.
Right.
But Joan, what happened was, is if you had a small business that had a, let's say it had a $5,000 line on a MasterCard credit card, and you and it, at some particular moment back in maybe January or February of this year, you only had $1,500 balance on that card, but $5,000 of credit, meaning you had $3,500 of headroom, availability, they call it.
Right.
And you went to charge something, and it was declined. And the reason it was declined is because when the credit crisis manifested last winter, the credit card companies said, okay, whatever these people, whatever their balance is, that's their new limit. And they arbitrarily, almost overnight, cut those credit availabilities down to whatever the balance was.
Yeah.
And that's really been tough on not only small businesses, Joan, but consumers.
Oh, sure.
Because, Joan, so much of consumer spending is based on credit, isn't it?
Well, no question about that.
And so this credit card thing is really a big concern. And Joan, I'm afraid that the credit card issue could be another shoe waiting to drop.
Right, and that's one of the concerns that came out at the congressional hearings this week, too, because they kept asking Chairman Bernanke, so what's the next crisis? What's the
right.
next crisis? And wondering if he, I don't know that he, I think he gave that as an example without saying it would be the next crisis.
Well, that's the big issue, isn't it? What, you know, if we do this is unprecedented. These are my words.
Right.
Folks, Kiplinger chose not to use that word, but I'm using it. It's unprecedented what's happening. So if we're having this much brain damage over this, if this is not everything, where do we go from here?
Exactly.
And and it has to be said, Joan, is this throwing good money after bad?
Right, and we don't know that yet.
That's the deal. That's what's got everybody uncertain. And Joan, this is different from the resolution trust of the late 80s and 90s, isn't it?
boy, well, that was a big deal at the time.
Yeah, but we knew what the crisis was. We knew what the damage was.
We
because
knew the
those,
limits of what the damage would be, I think,
because
much.
The banks had already failed. See?
Right, right.
We took over assets that were known values on banks that had already failed. We didn't have to buy anything. We didn't have to perceive a value. And this is, if you know, when they talk about, why don't we have another resolution trust thing, and that's kind of what this new plan is. It's similar, but it's not the same. And it's fraught with a lot more peril, frankly, on many levels. We'll come back. We're going to talk about some ways that you can save money when you're flying, or maybe when you decide to do something else besides fly. 20 till the hour. I'm Jim Blassingame. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's 17 till. I'm Jim Blassingame, the Small Business Advocate, and we're visiting with our good friend Joan Pride, Senior Editor with the Kiplinger Editors, a longtime member of our Brain Trust, celebrating 85 years of the Kiplinger Editors and the Kiplinger Letter, which is what Joan and I work off of every week. And so 85 good years with Kiplinger is a great American success story. Joan, the websites are smallbusinessadvocate.com. My websites are smallbusinessadvocate.com and askjim.biz. But Kiplinger has an outstanding website, which is Kiplinger, very simply, Kiplinger. I'm saying the G because that's how you spell it, K-I-P-L-I-N-G-E-R, Kiplinger.com. It's a really good website, Joan. I was there again the other day, and I mean, I go fairly frequently, but every time I go, I'm continue to be impressed, Joan.
I would hope you would.
You work hard on that too, don't you, Joan?
All the time. No, we have great people that work on that website, but I'm afraid I can't take credit for that.
Joan
even
has.
Though I would like to.
Joan has people, ladies and gentlemen.
Right.
And her peeps take care of it, folks. And of course, the publications are the Kiplinger Letter, the Weekly Letter, and then this 85 years in the making, and then of course the four biweeklies: the California, the Tax, the Agriculture, and the Biofuels Letter. And then there's that magazine thing.
That's right, Kiplinger's Personal Finance Magazine.
And that's you can find that at newsstands. And how about that phone number, Joan?
Right, our toll free number is 800-544-0155.
It's not 85 years old, is it? That phone number.
What, the toll free number?
Yeah, the toll free. No. I don't think it is.
Not quite.
Joan. When you're traveling these days by airplane, the expense that it takes when you buy your ticket, that's not always how much it's going to cost you to get where you're going, is it?
Is that right? There's extra fees now.
Some airlines charge you for the first checked bag, and more for the second, and more for the third. Some airlines will give you one checked bag, but they charge you for the second, and so on and so forth.
Right.
It could be 25. I mean, we took a third bag with us the other day, Joan, when we traveled last time, because I was compelled to bring my golf clubs.
Of course.
And so they charged me for that bag both ways. So I think it was about, I'm going to rephrase it. We went on U.S. Air, and it cost us $55 extra each way for all the bags that we checked.
You know, for a golf bag, that's inexcusable that they make you pay for a golf bag. That's
I think
it
should with a golf they should
just
pay
awful.
Me to take the golf bag. I think, but
boy, I'll say.
But Joan, the but $55. So that's whatever the ticket cost us. We had to pay an extra $110.
Wow.
To go. So and you know what, Joan? That's okay. If that's what they need to do, that's fine. But Joan, some airline, and I think maybe, I'm not sure which one, some airline now charges you if you get a soft drink.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's standard now. Not just for the liquor, for the soft drink.
Just a soft drink.
And the bottled water and the pillows and the blankets, too, I think.
Now, see, I think that's a mistake. Those are hospitality things. See, I don't have a problem, Joan. I don't have too much of a problem with checked bags because those are freight. I mean, that's weight that they have to carry, they have to handle, they have to deal with. And if you don't have a checked bag, Joan, you shouldn't have to pay for my extra checked bag. So I kind of understand that. But the hospitality stuff, the food and the drink, that's, in my opinion, that's a mistake.
Well, the thing that makes me able to handle this is they don't bar you from bringing your own stuff on it.
Like, oh, yeah.
If they told me, like, you know, like the movie theaters, if they told me you can't bring your own drinks on and you have to buy our stuff,
right,
then I would
right.
be upset.
Yeah. Joan, you know, do you remember after 9-1-1, I said that the biggest danger to the travel industry and the hospitality travel industry was going to be technology, not terrorism?
Yes.
Because I said video conferencing will be, in my opinion, more damaging over time to the airlines and the hotels and things like that. And, Joan, that technology is really, really getting good right now, especially
right.
with the, the video capability.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And, you know, Joan, more and more of these programs that you can do webinars on have a video component.
Yes.
And so you can give your presentation for a proposal or whatever, and you can see each other in inside of the program that allows you to post your presentation.
What more do you need?
Exactly. Now here's where things are lagging a little bit, Joan.
Mm-hmm.
The audio, including the audio in there without having to make a separate parallel phone call, that's lagging just a little bit. And when we get to the point where
say lagging, what do you mean? That you can't
In other words, it's a lot of these programs that you use now still don't have the ability for the connection that you make to make the presentation includes audio.
No kidding.
You have on many of them now, but on many of them, you actually have to make a parallel phone call and talk over the phone while you're watching online.
Oh, okay.
See what I mean?
Yeah.
But the technology is there. It's just that everybody hasn't quite gotten it together. But when that comes together, Joan, when those get integrated together, where you got presentation, you got video, you got audio, all in real time, I think that's going to be a paradigm shift, Joan.
Boy, I'll say, I would think it would be.
And see, Joan, that's going to save people a lot of money.
Yeah.
It's not going to be good for the airlines. It's not going to be good for travel industry. But it's going to save businesses money because, Joan, you know, you travel because you want to be able to see people face-to-face.
Right.
And maybe instead of me seeing that customer three times a year, maybe with video I can do it one time a year.
That's right. Or do it more often. You know, you might have wanted to make more trips but couldn't do so.
Exactly. So instead of, yeah, exactly. So instead of seeing each other three times a year, maybe we see each other six times, and one of them's face-to-face.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. Something to think about, folks. Quick break. Stay with us. Right back after these messages. Joan Pride is our guest. I'm Jim Blasingame. Hello, I'm Jim Blasingame, the small business advocate. Little Robert Cray bringing us back. Joan Pride is our guest. She's senior editor with the Kiplinger Editors. Joan, another thing that you guys reported was the advent or the increasing use of robots. You say more robots in the future. Now, what's that all about?
Well, this is kind of interesting. Robots are taking over lots of jobs, and this is the good part, especially repetitive and potentially dangerous ones.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for example, in the meat packing industry, packaging meats and poultry. Also testing, I don't know how a robot would test food samples for safety, because you would think a human would have to do that, but I guess they can.
Well, from a visual standpoint, but maybe the robot could be a camera, that a real person would view the camera.
Yeah, but they can't taste it is the problem.
Well, okay. Well, they don't taste raw food. I mean, I don't eat sushi either, so I don't know.
Right.
But no, you know, here's the thing, though, Joan. See, this is an issue that I've been talking about for a while, and I haven't heard anybody else talk about this. But I believe that it's a concern. I believe that the United States and other countries are going to be running into severe labor shortages in the next generation.
That's right.
Over the next 20 years, Joan.
Yep.
Japan has a falling birth rate. Europe has a falling birth rate. United States is not keeping up. If it weren't for immigrants, Joan, I think we'd have a falling population in a lot of ways if it weren't for immigrants.
Right. That's right.
And not only the ones coming in, but the ones but the babies that they're making. And I mean, I'm that's just a fact. I mean, it's just a statistical fact. And so what I'm saying is that, Joan, we've already got a labor shortage. Even with all the immigrants, Joan, You know, if you think about it, Joni, as tough as the economy's been, we still only have about a 6% unemployment rate, which is our unemployment rate is still below the 30-year average.
That's right.
Now, why would that be if we've got this kind of an economy? Well, I think it's because we already had a bunch of jobs going wanting. Some economists have said on the show that there may be as many as 2 million jobs that are unfilled in the United States.
Right. That's staggering.
So if I'm a small business owner, if I'm a business owner of any kind,
right,
and I want to try to grow my productivity and meet demand, global demand, what choice do I have, Joan?
Yeah, there sure aren't many.
So robots, and now you know the what's an ATM if not a robot, Joan?
Oh right, yeah.
What is a kiosk at the airport if not a robot?
Well, I guess I think of those as computers, but sure.
But they're robots.
Okay.
Don't they take something from you and give you something back?
If that's the definition of a robot, I guess they're robots.
Well, it's a mechanical device that does something that a human didn't have to do. Isn't that kind of the same thing as a robot?
I guess.
I mean, a robot doesn't have to look like R2-D2.
Okay, you win. That's fine.
So, I'm just saying, all I'm getting at is my point is we're already using robots. The public is already using robots. When you check out at Lowe's or Home Depot or the store, maybe the grocery store, and you can check yourself out. You've seen those, Joan. That's kind of a robot. And so,
okay. So
all I'm getting at is because that's really under. Once we think about it like that, we're all going to be using more of these in the future, partially because technology makes them more efficient, the humans,
right,
in certain areas, but also because there won't be anybody to do some of these jobs.
Well, that's the problem. Right?
You'll walk up to, before you and I die, Joan, maybe in the next 5 years, you'll go to McDonald's, you'll reach in and get your hamburger. After you swipe your money, the door will come open. Remember the automat, Joan, in New York City?
No, I do not.
You
I've
do
heard
too.
About it. I've
you
heard
know
stories
what,
about
you've
it.
You've seen the, you're not that young, Joan.
Well, I thought they kind of were on the way out in the 50s.
Oh no! Oh no, they were still in around in the like late 70s or something.
Oh really?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, I've never been in one.
Oh,
no.
I thought you'd. Okay,
yeah,
all right. I thought
no.
you'd. I knew that they
wow.
were here anyway. The automat where you put your dime in and you reach, and the window went up and you reached in and got your sandwich. That's kind of that automation, consumers have been using. So anyway, the point is that I think. This is where our technology, Joan, in the future will touch consumers, customers, more than ever before.
Right. Oh, no question.
And so my point to small business owners, Joan, mm-hmm. is never let your technology touch a customer unless there's something in it for them.
Ah.
That's the proper use of a robot. Make sure it benefits the customer. Otherwise, they won't use it. They'll go somewhere else.
Right. Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Vote
hey,
with
Joan,
their feet.
Happy anniversary.
Thank you very much.
All the best. And we'll celebrate the 170th birthday one day, Joan.
We're ready.
Thanks, Joan. See you next time.
Thank you, Jim.
Got to go for this hour. I'm Jim Blassingame, the Small Business Advocate, reminding you that a ship in the harbor is safe, but that's not what ships were made for.
Insperity presents the Small Business Advocate Show with Jim Blassingame. This is a copyrighted production of Small Business Network, Inc., intended for the private use of our audience. Except as otherwise provided by copyright law, all other copying, redistribution, or publication without prior written consent is prohibited. All rights reserved.